Session number 10699.
Brigadier Rymer Jones, Reel 14. What sort of, besides the Bloody Sunday attack, which you've already decided, what other attacks and what scale of attacks were they, Sinn Féin?
Well, they're much like the present attacks in Northern Ireland, where you've got murder of very largely of British officers, staff officers, like on Bloody Sunday there. And of course, regular attacks at night. Before that, one would be able to move about quite easily. After that, married people were brought in, and one only went to play football and rugger against other battalions in the thing with the loose guns shoved over the end. And nevertheless, it was extraordinary how one had this curious love and, I won't say hatred, of the Irish. They're a fascinating race. And I found them, after all, many of our senior army officers, generals of Wellington and so on, they were all Irish, you know. And tragedy is that you get this bad streak in so many of them. I met a very attractive type of great gaunt woman married to a Trinity College Dublin.
You mentioned her, yes.
I mentioned that to her. And I'd, during the Troubles, I'd gone out to try and capture a brother of hers who was head of the intelligence in Sinn Féin. And we very nearly caught him then. And it was then she told me that well, we found a cigarette still burning by his bedside, and he gone, that she'd seen that his revolver was still by the bed and had hidden it in the kettle. Well, she said to me the following morning, we were on holiday in Dublin, and she sang out from her table, Captain Rymer Jones, that's what she called me in those days. What do they think about us in England now? I said, I'm sorry to disappoint you, lady, but they aren't thinking of you at all. But she, as soon as the Ulster business was cleared up, Martha Griffiths and Collins were murdered, she and her husband, they fled and became outlaws themselves from De Valera and Kerr.
What did you think of the position of the Black and Tans,
Black and Tans were a bit rough, but as I have said to you before, if you'd had your friends murdered and stuffed down a drain and incidents like that, you wouldn't exactly be inclined to handle them well. That's not to say that I'm in favour of rough handling by troops or police, and I'm glad to say that in Palestine, I think we were the only force under pressure in the police who never failed to handle the thing as policemen should, in the very best way.
How did you have to liaise with the Black and Tans at all? Because they were an auxiliary organisation.
No, we did. They came under Tudor, as the auxiliaries did. General Tudor was out there organising theirs, and he was responsible for getting most of the Baghdad out to Palestine afterwards to form the gendarmerie in the early days. Magnificent crowd of men. I know because I commanded them, the individuals, afterwards. And I think it's terrible, really, that marvellous men like that should be under pressure in the way they were there in Palestine. And everywhere where they'd been used with accusations of brutality and so on, which weren't there, most of them having been in the army, as most of them as officers, during the First Great War. I think the trouble is that when you've had a war like that, that you should avoid, if it's at all possible, putting those same people who've been through it into a position where they're being attacked by, whether it's Sinn Féiners or IRA these days. It's all right what you've got now, these youngsters, they're under great pressure, but they haven't been through a long war where you take it as an insult if then people are starting to murder you all around.
How did you come to leave Ireland then? You just...
Well, I was posted away. You see, I was posted out there in the first place. It isn't for me to say I don't want to go and I can't go. As a matter of fact, I was posted a very nice intelligence job in Germany.
And when did you leave?
When I first went to Ireland. And my CO, who said to me, "You are now one of my officers." And I got on very well with him, you see. He kept me there. And when I was posted to this very good job in Ireland from the War Office, he said, "No, nobody's consulted me. This is one of my officers. I haven't been told anything about it. He's just had an order to go to Germany." And he won. And I had to stick there. I was very annoyed at the time. But I was very pleased that they should think I was sufficiently available to do it. Well, the time came, and this was only a few months before we packed up there all together. And so I left them, you see, and I went to... first of all, I went to Upper Silesia for a short job, and then was moved to Cairo. And it was then that I first had my Palestine contacts. And so on. I had a letter from a friend I'd made in the battalion in Ireland when they marched out. The people again, as they had after Bloody Sunday, lined the streets and called out to the troops as they marched by, "Come back again, dear," to Polarish, you see. But how are you to tackle people like that? Very difficult. But at any rate, they've got nothing to be ashamed of, any of our troops out there.
Right. We're now going to move on. Most of the rest of your interwar career is covered in your memoirs, and I don't think we want to run through all that, or we've agreed not to. And the next thing we really want to look at is your experiences during the Blitz, when you were with the Blitz, and you wanted to set the scene.
You might say that Blitz, that's really experiences in the war. And perhaps I can start off in that way. Okay. After my first year with the Metropolitan Police, I was promoted and became a superintendent in charge of one of the largest divisions in the Metropolitan Police, with my headquarters at Croydon. And an enormous area with about 800 police. And a very interesting time, because in this particular division there was a lot of minor corruption, which Trenchard had been so keen to stamp out all around. And my predecessor, the superintendent, when people from the yard came to look into his affairs, he jumped out of a window and no more was heard of him. And I took over a magnificent lot of men who were in a very bad state. And their morale was very low, too. Well, my main interest then was to restore it. And I can assure you the only way to start with that is to restore their support. And I started Rugger there, and I restored their broken soccer too. I started paying for their boxing. And Sir Philip Graham, who was then the, what's it called, he was very keen on this, and he started the Philip Graham Club after I'd left, down in Croydon. And before I left, the morale had come up. We'd beaten the best sides at Stocker. We drew the best side at Rugger. Much of my friend Phil Morganson discussed, because it was his champions that we beat. And we liked ourselves very much. Now, this is what I tried to do in Palestine afterwards, because I was told morale was low when I first went out there. And I can assure you that it's a joy to find these fellows winning all the medals afterwards, you know. And I don't mean only sport. So, the next year again, the second year, I was again promoted. Before our promotion, in 1936, I went to the yard. A strange incident in which I was directly involved occurred at the Epsom Derby meeting in 1936. On that occasion, the royal family stated their intention to stay away from the meeting as the king was ill, and that made my job considerably easier. So I thought, Epsom was on W Division, but it was traditionally the duty of Superintendent Z, that's mine, to control the traffic for a radius of 5 miles all round the grandstand. During the morning of Derby Day, a police motorcyclist brought me a message to the effect that a royal car, with the number stated, would leave St James Palace at a certain time, and arrangements would have been made to meet car at a rendezvous and escort to grandstand. First I hastened to the racecourse to warn the district commander, and then back to Banstead Crossroads, and in due course led the royal car to the racecourse. Outside the grandstand, a police cordon had been put in position, and a large crowd gathered there, sensing that something important was going to occur. My little procession swept round to a halt. Out of the royal car stepped Mrs. Simpson and went into the royal box. I had been promoted again to chief constable, a rank later changed to commander. I took charge of half the branches of D Department organisation, Deputy Assistant Commissioner Harry Archer having the other half, the whole being under that strange character, George Abbess, soon to be Sir George, who was a hard taskmaster and had a curious habit of building up his assistants and then undermining them. He had great influence with the commissioner, Sir Philip Graham, but he fell when clashing with the next one, Sir Harold Scott. It was a busy time for me, and I learnt a lot about organisation and administration, but it was mostly indoor office work, which, though useful and important in its way, not the same attraction for me as the outside world of men, or what might describe as police active service. My promotion coincided with that of my friend Alec Duncan. He was the chief CID officer at Bow Street, who was appointed as Commissioner of Police Victoria, Australia, a job calling for firm and expert handling. Little Australian MP, I think from New South Wales, walked around in my large office, swinging his umbrella and taking imaginary golf shots with it. He said, "You tell that Duncan to take six strong Met policemen with him, or they will do him down in Victoria." I relayed the message to Alec, who was rather amused, and went out to do a really fine job. Toward the end of 1938, George Ebbets planned to get rid of Harry Archer, who was rather frightened of him and wasn't happy away from the district. I argued with George and didn't receive anything harsher than, "You're losing the swarthy juices of the savage lad." So Harry went back to his old district command while I took over his group of branches, including D4, Communications, the nerve centre of New Scotland Yard, dealing with emergency calls. 999, but badly placed in the building's top story. Hitler certainly saved us a lot of trouble by marking time in the phony war, by giving us time to put some of our weaknesses right. With the increasing probabilities of being involved in a Second World War, we were already making preparations for dealing with attacks on London from the air, both by high explosive and gas.
How did you go about doing that, to break in there?
Well, that's enormous. If I may just follow. Tom Fallon, the clever, amusing, but difficult chief inspector in charge of the communications branch, was already well advanced with siren coverage of London, and D1 branch, dealing with clothing and equipment, was making provision for protective clothing, gas masks, blackouts, torches, and a dozen other items of equipment which would have to be provided on a big scale to deal with numerous police buildings and over 20,000 policemen, an immense task. That was roughly the position in the summer of 1939 when I took a house at Milton-on-Sea for a summer holiday. My wife Molly and I were determined to find a holiday cottage. So after the seaside, we sent Nanny and the three children home, then had a quick drive round Sussex, Surrey and Kent on a desperate hunt. On the last day which we could spare, we found the ideal cottage in Sandhurst, Kent, practically on the Sussex border. Which cottage was our ideal, and though not boasting much in the way of mod con, was very attractive and gave us all the accommodation we needed. It was originally a Flemish weaver's cottage, and more recently Fenimore Cooper, author of The Last of the Mohicans and Other Joys of My Youth, had lived there for 15 years. I had to get back to work, but my family occupied it to finish the summer and were there almost providentially at the outbreak of war. Made a good base for them for the first year, and it was easy for me to pay them a quick visit about once a fortnight from London. When war appeared inevitable, I'd been through a stiff medical at the War Office, and as I was on a regular army reserve of officers, would, when war was declared, go to my mobilisation job on Lord Gort's staff in the British Army Expeditionary Force. But everything was changed because London, it was thought, would immediately come under heavy bombing, and regular officers who had transferred to police could not be spared from their most valuable role helping London's population and keeping law and order in conditions of war. And so we came to the day when Chamberlain in the House of Commons told MPs in the country that Britain had declared war on Germany. As he sat down, and in a moment of high drama, every siren in London sounded the alarm on the receipt of air raid warning red. Tom Fallon's office was next to mine, and together we raced for the stairs leading to the information room. We got on the telephone to discover the cause of this apparent false alarm, and while doing so, one of the duty PCs addressed himself in protective clothing. and with his gas mask on, came to Tom seeking approval. Tom looked up and said, "You haven't got your gloves on," and then got on with his inquiries, which showed the alarm had come from misunderstanding at the Air Ministry. Meanwhile, my department messenger found me and said that the two elderly ladies, describing themselves as my aunts, would like a word with me when I could manage it. They proved to be my favourite Aunt Ada and her friend, my honorary aunt and joint godmother, Mary. They had a flat in Abingdon Court, just off High Street, Kensington, and were both in their late 80s. When I found them in the commissioner's waiting room, they said, "The family say we must leave London. We don't want to, need we?" I said, "No, and tomorrow I shall come and stay with you." That was the mutually agreeable arrangement for most of the time, until I went abroad, and both brave old ladies were there during the London Blitz and were still there when the war ended. Second false alarm had much more serious consequences. In order to get full coverage by sirens, one at each police station, only provided a part of our requirements. The not very successful Abbas police box schemes did provide places which could be permanently manned in telephone contact and with sirens on poles erected close outside. The third group were those on factory buildings and the like, functioned as pick-up sirens, an arrangement which proved to have its dangers. It was about this time someone sent me a copy of Samuel Butler's couplet, misquoting, "Alas, what perils do environ the man who trifles with a siren." And how right this proved, though in the end the system worked very well. On the fatal morning, an elderly policeman was on duty at one of these boxes. Was feeling upset because his relief for refreshments was overdue. Seeing a police war reservist passing by, he hailed him and said, "Take over from me, lad, I'm due for refreshments, and my relief is late." "It's quite easy, and you don't sound your siren unless your phone message says air raid warning red." So the war reservist took over, and being nervous about the job, was very sure the first warning that he got must be read, so he sounded the siren. That would have been all right if the message had been telephoned to all siren holders, but not so, for the pick-up sirens all joined in the chorus, and London went into action. Senior police officers were not allowed in special cars during the war, and I was walking in uniform from Kensington to the Yard. I had nearly reached Hyde Park Corner when the siren sounded. Policemen on point duty were struggling into protective clothing, and people were wondering whether to take cover or just carry on. I found an altercation between a decent-looking man in a tin hat and a group of people led by an angry man with a large head and a small bowler hat. He said to me, "Stop this man from persecuting the public. He is trying to force us into shelters and is pulling passersby off their bicycles with his stick." I found that the steel-helmeted gentleman was somebody something, senior air raid warden. I said to the complainant, "I'm sure the warden is really doing his best to help you." And to the warden, "For goodness sake, calm down and don't take your instructions too literally." I then handed over the problem to a passing constable, wondering what problems I should meet with next. It was clear it was too dangerous for us to continue with pick-up sirens as a major factor in our warning system, and I asked for their replacement by a still larger number of siren positions manned or controlled by police. Emerson Sir Philip Game opposed me with the notion that the phony war would continue until some arrangement for peace had been obtained. It was lucky that they had to give way, as it would never have been possible to test Saren coverage in the Blitz. There were, however, a number of special pickups which we retained and put them under our direct control, the outstanding one being the enormously powerful one at Woolwich Arsenal, known as Bellyache Sal, with a very wide and powerful coverage. Any limitation of duty hours for officers had, of course, disappeared, including the weekend. I shall always remember the Sunday afternoon when I went with Tom Fallon to see the very first practical and secret radar in action, tracking all planes approaching UK. Gave one a nice feeling to know we were ahead of the Germans in at least one particular. Family were enjoying life at Quince Cottage, and when Molly came to London with a child returning to school or for other purposes, we started our wartime visits to our much-loved Savoy Hotel, where for a ridiculously small sum, one could get dinner, dancing with the Savoy Orpheans, and bed for the night. Occasionally the room for the dinner dance had to be changed owing to bomb damage, but the hotel could say, with the Windmill Theatre, we never closed. Meanwhile, everything changed in May 1940, when the Germans broke the Allies' front in France and Belgium, and retreat became almost a rout, which we lost almost all our built-up stocks of arms, shells, every kind of stores necessary to keep an army operational. The so-called miracle of Dunkirk left us with a little beyond the large number of rescued soldiers, including those of our allies, to face the threat of invasion from sea and air. We still had, however, the spirit of our people, who, led by Churchill, achieved the impossible. D Department were told, prepare a room in the yard for all stocks of rifles, pistols and sporting guns collected from gunsmiths and shops. Wisely, we made careful lists of these valuable weapons, and when later they were handed over to the army, the lists were checked and signed for by the receivers. This taught me a lesson in the care of other persons' property, as there came a day when the army claimed they had not received some of the weapons. 5 years later, in Palestine, my force were rather spitefully accused by the Secretariat of irregularities in respect of disposal of enemy property. Fortunately, I had made my quartermasters deal meticulously with this matter, and I received no reply to my report, and incidentally no apology. To meet the threat of invasion in 1940, every citizen had, in some way or another, to be brought into the home battlefront. Day came when Anthony Eden got up in the House of Commons and announced the formation of the LDV, Local Defence Volunteers, a title later to be changed to Home Guard. Anybody wishing to join was told to report to their nearest police station, and we told the police stations to get applicants to fill up forms. I was in Sir George's office when suddenly it seemed that every police station in London wanted to speak to him at once.